eat with aggression and then try to tell the story afterward. I say no. I say we get our story straight and then use what's left of our war machine to hammer that story into the hearts and minds of the galaxy and its people.
And what story would that be?
Grand Moff Rand asks, his tone crisp, clipped, and sharply uncertain.
What is our narrative?
That showman's smile from Abjur when he explains.
It is exactly as Sloane said. We are the underdogs. Everyone loves an underdog. So we lean into that, not away from it. We play the wounded animal. The loyal hound who has been kicked out by a brutal, unjust, and altogether unready father.
From the back of the room comes a gentle applause. A sound that grows more insistent as it gets closer. And from the dark outside the dining table comes the fleet admiral himself, Gallius Rax. It surprises her not at all that this is when he chooses to emerge. It's the most dramatic moment, isn't it? There sits Ferrick, giving his speech about narrative and story, and oh, how closely it mirrors Rax's feelings about artifice and the ephemeral, uncertain nature of truth.
This, Rax begins, is precisely why I have selected you all. Such good ideas. Such impeccable wisdom. The truth of the matter is, we have lost this war. The Empire, as we knew it, is gone. Already we were letting it slip when the Rebel Alliance grew in unseen spaces like a cancer.
Discomfort manifests around the table as those seated shift in their chairs.
For us, this represents an opportunity to reshape ourselves. That is why I have gathered you all here. A veritable brain trust of the first and most vital among us. It is on us to retake and control the narrative.
In his hand, he gestures with what looks to be a small controller.
What will our story be? What or who is the Empire?
Hux leans in, desperation glinting in his eyes.
And how exactly do we retake our story? Propaganda is all well and good, but we still need resources. It's not the narrative we're losing. It's people and ships and...
Here he looks to General Borum.
And vehicles on the ground.
A slow, chilling smile settles across Rax's face. Then he hits a button. From a centerpiece in the table, hidden from view, a HoloLens projects images all around them, above them, behind them, everywhere. What it shows is galactic space, stars and systems, clouds and hyperspace routes. It is not one map, but several slices of the overall galaxy.
It is time, Rax says, to expose my rules.
He hits a button again. The air shifts and shimmers, and now they're looking at thick interstellar clouds. Nebulae. Like the one they're hiding in right now. The Vulpinus.
Sloane knows her galactic map well. As a naval officer, it would do her little good to be ignorant of the stars.
She spies 5 known nebulae. The red clouds of the Almagest. The bruised dark striations of the Recluse's Nebula, the sapphire orb of the Quel'Yuhan, the spiraling Rolu Triangle, and the bleak columnar plumes of the Inamorata. What ruse will he expose? The truth of it reaches her before he speaks. Just as they are hiding in one nebula, so too are other fleets. They are not alone out here. They are not the last fleet.
Rax confirms exactly that. Portions of our naval fleet have been hidden since not long after the destruction of our glorious battle station over the Endor moon. These fleets are not as large as the one we currently control here in the Vulpinus. Yet they are substantive just the same. Hundreds of star destroyers, thousands of smaller craft.
Sloane is left reeling. She feels gutted, like a dolo fish, its belly slit so that its steaming innards can lie on the dock while it gasps in the open air. Even now, her lips work soundlessly in the same way. She tries to find words, tries to find something. She should be happy, shouldn't she? That the Empire's demise is not so plainly written? But all she feels is disappointment and anger, a red, rising anger. She's about to erupt. And then Rax says,
Admiral Sloane and I felt it was necessary to maintain this ruse. We simply did not know who to trust.
A second blow. He included her in the conspiracy. A conspiracy she literally just learned about alongside the rest of the Shadow Council. They're staring at her. Betrayal in their eyes. But something else, too. Admiration. That sickens her the most. They admire the plan he created, and she has been given undue credit for it. Why? Why did he do that to her? All she can do is grit her teeth and nod. Exposing him now would seem untoward. Worse, it would show him for being someone gracious enough to give credit to an inferior and reveal her as unappreciative of a bone thrown in her direction.
But I want more than just a bone, she thinks. I want the whole damn animal.
That is the only way the Empire will be kept safe and strong. Its leash held firmly in her grip. Now is not that time. Instead, she sucks it up and leans into it.
She says, summoning a swell of false confidence,
With Palpatine's demise, it was clear that some factions within the Empire would attempt to wrest control. Pantheon was an excellent example of this. A greedy man using the chaos to extend his reach. Further, we had no way of knowing who would attempt to save their own skins by running to the New Republic. We had to be sure that we revealed this to those vital few we could trust. That's all of you.
Now admiration shines at her from a different set of eyes, from Gallius Rax himself. The corner of his lip is twisted up in a mischievous hook as he regards her.
He is pleased with me, she thinks.
It warms her and chills her at the same time.
The fox is pleased with the hen.
Is she falling for his strange way? Does she admire him now? She might. Even as she hates him, she admires him too.
We need more than fleets, Borum says. We need boots on the ground and the armor to go with him.
Good news, then, Rax answers. The factories of Kuot have been bombed into submission, and the shipyards of Jar Fell, Anadine, and Turok Prime are all either contested or already lost. But the Outer Rim will be our savior, and it will be the strangling cord we tie around the neck of the New Republic. We already have 3 worlds under our sway there. Jadaline, Chorus, and Belladoon. The Empire has long, to its detriment, relied on third-party corporations to produce the pieces of our war machine, but that is no longer the case. Production is entirely imperial. And on these worlds, we have already begun to produce our weapons. All-terrain walkers, new TIE starfighters, E-11 rifles, and the other necessities of war. Hux sits stunned.
We still need personnel. We need new academies.
In due time, Rax says sharply.
Sloane is so busy watching the reactions of the men at the table to this news, spying the competing emotions of relief and fear and rage on these men's faces, that she fails to notice someone else come into the room. someone who steps up behind her and places a gentle hand on her shoulder. She startles as Adia whispers,
"Admiral, we have a situation."
A hot flash of anger rises in her, and for a moment she's about to chastise the poor girl in front of everyone. But that won't do. It isn't earned. Sloane is on edge, and if Adia says that a situation demands her attention, then she must trust it to be true. It takes every ounce of willpower to get up from that table. Excluding herself from the meeting, even for 1 second, will make her feel robbed of information. And in this empire, information is power. Chapter 13. Out there, the Star Destroyer is in the slow-motion midst of its destruction. The elimination of a capital ship like that is rarely fast. It's bled like a great beast, like a purgle punctured over and over by hook lashes before it can be brought up on deck. Missile streaks and laser fire crisscross the endless dark, and slowly but surely, the destroyer is ripped asunder as the vacuum of space sucks great gulps of fire from fissures in its hull. And then, like that, it's over. Through the dark cascades, a great pulsing flash from engines gone supernova. It burns its image into Nora's retina. And now when she blinks, she sees the skeletal frame of that ship just before it's gone. All that's left out there now is debris. And though she cannot see them from here, bodies. At the Empire's peak, a Star Destroyer played host to around 40,000 crew, Commodore Augate says, walking up behind Nora. Our best guess was that ship out there, the Scythe, had far fewer than that on board, closer to 15,000. That's still a great many lives lost. Augate is tall, rail thin, with broad shoulders and long legs. Her chin is held high. Her hair is short. A dark curl around each ear is as ostentatious as it gets. The Commodore keeps her hands held behind her back. Nora knows the woman has a reputation for her trembling hands. Once it earned her dismissiveness and doubt, but that has changed. Kirsta Augate has proven her place time and time again. Many admire her earnestness. Though now, Nora wonders what the woman is getting at.
I don't understand, Nora says. We did this. This is war.
That's exactly right. This is war. It's easy to get caught up in the swell of it. The medals, the parades, the garlands of Larrakid petals on the victor's brows. But it's important to remember that war is mostly this. Destruction and death. We are killers.
Nora fails to suppress a tremor of her own.
Are you saying we're in the wrong? With all due respect, Commodore Augate, I can't believe that.
Augate turns. Her smile is sad.
No, we are doing just work. Those on board the Scythe knew who they were and why they were there. And they were not ignorant of the cost of war. I just want my people not to be ignorant of it either.
You want us to regret what we've done?
To her surprise, Augate nods.
I do. A little. We should. I don't want unrepentant killers, Lieutenant Wexley. I want soldiers who hate what they had to do and fear having to ever do it again.
And if that means we lose the war?
Then we lose the war by keeping ourselves.
That hits her like a fist. She feels staggered by it. Dizzy, almost.
Thanks, Nora says.
Though the way she says that word, Nora frames it almost as much a question as a statement of gratitude. Augate nods.
I spoke to Captain Antilles. He told me why you were out here.
Nora wonders idly if he told a lie, given that their purview to track the missing Han Solo was not exactly official. But when she hears the tale told true, She knows Wedge may not be capable of such an easy lie. Han Solo is missing?
He is. And there may be Imperial entanglements.
Let's hope you find him.
Let's hope they continue to let us find him. He resigned his military commission.
Augate sighs. That may complicate things.
I'm betting on it.
In front of the Moth, on one of the decks of the Concorde, Wedge meets Nora once more. He's nervous. He looks around at the bright, clean curves of the Starhawk's interior.
One hell of a ship, huh?
She agrees, and she tells him so. It's different to be in a ship that feels so new. It almost feels fake somehow, or like she doesn't belong. Even something as simple as a docking bay, above, the ceiling is sculpted in white scalloped edges, and all is lit with a warm glow, rather than harsh lighting. The floors are lit, too, from underneath.
Listen,
he says, leaning forward on his cane.
I told Augate.
He doesn't have to say about what.
I know. She knows we're looking for Solo. It's fine.
Akbar's gonna want to have a conversation.
I accept that.
You should be really steamed.
I'm not. Really.
I just figured if anyone was going to betray Leia, I'd rather it be me and not you. Though, that means I had to betray you, somewhat.
Wedge, it's okay.
Promise?
I swear by all the stars and all the skies.
He raises an eyebrow.
About that drink.
Nora kisses him.
She does it before she even realizes she's doing it.
Her eyes close.
She draws a sharp intake of breath through her nose as they hold the kiss. Her heart feels heavy in her chest, as for just a fleeting moment, she thinks of her husband, Brenton. When she finally pulls away, it feels like forever has eclipsed them. That so much time has passed that the war may be over, and all that has come before can be willfully forgotten. An illusion, she knows, but a comforting one. She smiles. He smiles, too.
About that drink,
she says, aiming to put some singier swagger in her voice.
I'm sure they have a bar somewhere on this ship. I say we find it.
Chapter 14. For the first 12 years of Gallius Rax's life, music was a thing that simply did not exist. Yes, the music of his surroundings played. Wind whistling through the stone spires, the jostling of rust-bone chimes made by the anchorites, the melodic hum of a speeder cutting a swath across the hissing sand. But real music? True music, orchestrated willfully by the hands and the breath and the sheer bloody desire of sentient beings? That was unknown to him. The first piece he ever heard as a boy plays in his chambers now. The cantata of Cora Vesora, an old Republic opera of a dark witch on an unnamed world who refused to become Jedi. But neither would she join the Sith. It is a tale of birth, death, and all the glories found between those poles. Love, passion, war, and above all else, revenge. Revenge against the Sith who took her loved ones. Revenge against the Jedi for standing idly by and refusing to protect her because she would not join their ranks. Revenge against the galaxy for being as imperfect and impure as she had feared. The tale itself was something he didn't learn until much later. The story mattered, of course, but as a child taking his first flight off a grim, dust-choked planet that he thought, or feared, was the center of the galaxy, it was the sound of the music that haunted him. Now as much as then. The light pluck of the Modacor's strings, the crash and clamor of the dendodrums, glass breaking and remaking and breaking over and over again. The vibration formed of the choral ululations from the unglanded Takari singers. A vibration that can be felt as an intense buzzing in one's temples and jaw. A vibration that can make one feel almost drunk on it. He lets it wash over him, standing in the center of it, almost as if the music can pick him up and lift him higher. Rax is aware of someone in the room with him. Likely it's Sloane, here to ask him about the destruction of the scythe. She won't accuse him of anything. Sloane is too smart for that, though he fears that day is coming. He will not have the cantata interrupted, though. Not for her. Not for anyone. So he stands, swaying gently, and he holds up an insistent finger, demanding patience above all else. It plays out into silence, and only then does he turn. It is not Sloane standing there. Rather, it is her aide, Adia Wright.
"Miss Wright," he says, "I am surprised to see you here, and not her."
"She chose not to come."
He lifts his brows.
"She discovered the destruction of the scythe."
Adia confirms with a nod.
"And she learned that I sent out a transmission."
"Both transmissions."
It is a shame that Admiral Sloane has not come to talk this through with him. He understands why, of course. She feels lied to. Because she has absolutely been lied to. And that deception will not end any time soon. It cannot end, because she cannot know everything. Not yet. If only she would trust him. An ironic statement, he knows, given that all she has on him are mounting reasons not to trust him. But leaders are like this sometimes. You must place trust in them, even when you are uncertain that they are making the right choice. No, not trust. Faith.
"Ray Sloane will come around," Rax says,
suddenly confident. He reaches out and takes both of Adia's hands. Her eyes shine with veneration, though in there he sees something else, a conflict. Adia respects and admires Sloane, too. This is hard for her. Good. It should be.
"We do what we must. The sacrifice of the scythe was a necessary one. Besides, Commander Valent was conspiring with Loring. We cannot stand any more needless fractures in this, and he was too stubborn to be brought into the fold, not to mention incompetent."
"Can I share this information with Admiral Sloane?"
He pulls her closer, gently easing her so that her chin is on his chest.
"Yes, you may, but not yet."
"I should be getting back."
He can feel her heart beating against his own, faster now, a rabbit's pace. Rax gently places a finger under her chin and lifts it toward him. "Will you stay the night again?" he asks.
"I..."
"You must. I insist."
He eases forward to meet her. He presses his lips against hers, cold against warm. The kiss of fire against a shard of ice. The scythe is destroyed. Commander Valent and all those on board are dead. And it's her fault. Or it was made to seem like her fault. There, on her comm, a message sent to the scythe from her station and with her clearance codes. Text only. No visuals, no audio. That message asked the scythe to respond to an alarm signal sent from a Prowler probe droid. Then someone went ahead and blocked all incoming messages from the scythe, so that distress signals from the destroyer failed to arrive. And finally, the last piece of a troubling puzzle, yet another missive sent out through heavily encrypted channels onward to the New Republic. That's him, That's her so-called advisor, Fleet Admiral Rax. He's been stringing along the New Republic as a character he called the Operator now for the better part of 3 months. But it seems he's more interested in maneuvering the Empire into cannibalizing itself, giving the fledgling Republic a much-needed edge. He's handing them the weapons and then shoving Imperials into firing range. Before, she could maybe excuse it. Certainly remnants of the Empire truly were out for themselves. May the stars help them all if someone like Pandion were to capture the Imperial throne. But this? The scythe? That was an execution. Because surely it was the Fleet Admiral who summoned the New Republic ships under the guise of the Operator. Him tugging their leash and giving those scum the scent of another good Imperial target. Thousands of soldiers are now dead because of it. And why? For what purpose? Shaking, Sloane paces her office, trying to figure out exactly that. Valent? He was loyal, was he not? Maybe that's an overestimation. She sits down at her holoscreen and pulls up all the information she has on the scythe and Commander Valent. Everything seems standard, but there. Wait. Valen didn't go to Naval Academy first, did he? He went to the officer school on Uiter, along with Grand General Loring. So that's it. Another rivalry extinguished. One more potential dissenter whose throat is metaphorically slit. Instead of trying to bridge the divide and lead from the center, Rax is happy to drift to the edges, and those who don't follow him will be shot like dogs. Sloane cries out in rage and sweeps everything off her desk. A tumbler of water spills and rolls away. She is left seething, her chest rising and falling, as she envisions marching into Rax's chambers and putting 2 blaster shots through his forehead. All for what he's done. This is not my empire, she thinks. But how to reclaim it? Exposing Rax is an option, but the consequences of that may not play out in her favor. First, she'll have to openly admit that she does not control this empire. Second, he's a war hero. And no matter who you are, as an Imperial, those medals matter. Third, the response might be an overwhelming shrug. So what, they may say? That he's a manipulator? Palpatine was too. In its earliest days, the nascent Empire grew strong precisely because he let the Republic and the Jedi destroy each other. And then, he simply seized the pre-existing war machine for himself, uniting the fissures in the galaxy under the Imperial banner. They might have faith in Gallius Rax's choices, however grim, however strange. Exposing him exposes her, too. Worse, it potentially pushes the Empire into its own internal civil war. It's time to stop dithering. It's time to head to Quan Chi and find the wreckage of the Imperialis. If droids remain, even in scrap, maybe she can find something, anything, that can shed light on who Rax is or what his true intentions may be. With that, Sloane launches up out of her chair, renewed with vigorous purpose. She strides to the door, opens it with a hiss. There stands Ferrik Abjur. He gives an obsequious smile.
We have another meeting regarding information dissemination, and we should prepare a statement regarding the loss of Arcanis. Oh, and it's vital we establish some vague sense of the future of the Empire. We can discuss the new breeding initiatives, for instance, and...
As he goes on, she nods gamely. All the while, Sloane feels like her boots are stuck in a mire, and the mud keeps pulling her down, 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 until her mouth is full of it, and her lungs are full too, and all she can do is drown in the muck as the Empire she loves slips away. Interlude. Takodana. There's only one rule in Maz Kanata's castle. Well, okay, there are dozens, even hundreds of rules. If you get up on stage, you have to perform. Don't drink what's in the brown jug. Don't go downstairs. If your animal drops a pile anywhere, you're out. All deals need the approval of Maz before they're done, and if you try to go around her back, she'll take what's yours and what's his and sell all of it to the highest bidder. And for the love of all that is holy, don't mention Maz's eyes unless you want to get into a very long conversation. But there's only one spoken rule. Written, too. In 100 languages. Many of them long forgotten. On the wall beyond the bar. All are welcome. No fighting. That rule is simple on the surface, but not easy in the execution. Because Maz Kanata's castle has been a meeting place since time immemorial. A nexus point drawing together countless lines of allegiance and opposition. A place not only where friend and foe can meet, but where complex conflicts are worn down flat so that all may sit, have a drink and a meal, listen to a song, and broker whatever deals their hearts or politics require. That's why the flags outside her castle represent hundreds of cities and civilizations and guilds from before forever. The galaxy is not now, nor has it ever been, two polar forces battling for supremacy. It has been thousands of forces. A tug of war not with a single rope, but a spider's web of influence, dominance and desire. Clans and cults, tribes and families, governments and anti-governments. Queens, satraps, warlords, diplomats, buccaneers, droids, slicers, spicers, ramblers, and gamblers. To repeat, all are welcome. No fighting. You fight, you're done. How done you are is a permutation left to Kanata herself. Maybe that means you're out on your can. Maybe it means you end up locked away for however long she chooses. Maybe, just maybe, if she really doesn't like you, it means she takes you up on one of her many ships, the Tuolu, a.k.a. the Stranger's Fortune, and forces you to walk the airlock and meet the stars. Sitting at the bar presently is an Imperial officer in the ISB. At least, he thinks he's still with the ISB. Truthfully, Agent Romwell Crass doesn't even know if the ISB is functioning fully anymore. He had been stationed on the Hyborian moon at a black site prison. His family lived there on that moon. His wife, Yaelin, his son, Carwell. His father, Romwell Sr. His friends in the Bureau lived there, too. Crass worked very hard behind the scenes to ensure the transfer of those he came up with in the Empire, because the Hyborian moon was a cushy, easy job. The prison was locked up tight. The work was clean and simple. You got housing by the shore of one of the hot spring lakes. And at the end of it all, a commendation awaited for work performed, for loyalty sustained, for virtue upheld. And then, the rebels came. He won't deign to call them the Republic, new or old. They are anarchist scum, undeserving of the dignity. They came out of hyperspace with a small fleet of ships, and before anyone knew what was happening, hell rained on them from above. They fired on the remaining structures. They fired on the houses. Spears of scourging light rent Romwell's home from the surface. His family was inside when it happened. They are dead now. And he is alive because as rebel scum flooded the prison, he fled to the nearest ship and escaped to hyperspace before they could disable the craft. That was a month ago. He contacted Coruscant. The Bureau there was under siege, and he told them he would show up, provide backup. But he didn't. Instead, he just wandered, floating for a while, weeping over the pictures of his family, screaming in rage at those who had done this. Even now, his eyes grow wet at the thought of it. It's like
Something wants to crawl up out of him. A screaming monster with breath of fire. He washed up here 2 days ago. He wanted information on whoever did this. Who gave the order to wipe out his home? The Republic prides themselves on being noble. Their snotty noses thick with the mucus of righteousness. And yet how do they justify what they did? Why did they kill his family? His son, Carwell, was only 5. He liked to draw in moon dust. He had an MSE mouse droid unit as a pet. The boy was sweet and fun, and he had a big vocabulary and an even bigger heart. He would one day have made a most excellent Imperial Security Bureau officer. Better than Romwell. Better even than the boy's own grandfather. Now that boy is gone. And it is the rebels' fault. Wonder of wonders. Right here, right now, Romwell sees such a rebel. There, on the far side of the bar, closer to the stage, sits his enemy. The rebel is a lean fellow, with a pretty boy jaw and a swoop of dark hair. On his pilot jacket sleeve is the emblem of the so-called New Republic. He's there with a woman. Their heads nod to the music. Some mad-sounding song from Minlan Wile and the Tam Honil 3. Romwell can read the sign not far away. All are welcome, no fighting. Blah, blah, blah. He knows it. He comprehends it. But he's been drinking. And that rebel is a pilot. The Hyborian moon fell to the rebels. Pilots made that happen. Even now he remembers the trio of Y-wings roaring above his head, dropping their payload. He bets this man flies a Y-wing. Crass decides rather immediately. That rebel scum was one of them. One of his family's killers. Anarchist. Murderer. He's sure of it. He has no reason to be sure of it. But the more he drinks, the deeper his certainty. There comes a moment when the band stops playing, and there's a pause between sets. And once more, the sound of the crowded castle fills his ears. And it's enough to get him to stand. He pays up, slapping a handful of Imperial credits flat on the bar top. Then Romwell pushes his way past a trio of screeching Chadra fan throwing dice in a gambler's trap. He bumps a table of Bravasian guilders licking palmfuls of glittering gems. They squawk at him as he passes. Not that he cares. Passing by a sad-faced Skrilling sleeping next to a round jug of bubbling wine, Romwell hooks a finger around the jug handle and lifts it. It's full. It's heavy. It's perfect. The woman sees him first. Romwell's still in his officer's black. He hasn't changed out of it in a long time. Her eyes go wide, and she grabs the pilot's elbow, and just as the rebel thug turns, Romwell says, his voice oozily slurring from all the drink, "You killed my family!" Then he clocks the rebel across the head. Or rather, he tries to. The jug is heavy, and the rebel traitor isn't drunk. So the pilot moves fast enough to take the hit on the shoulder. He still goes down, though, and Romwell barks a muddy laugh. What surprises him is when the woman stands up and throws a hard, straight punch to his chops. His nose pops like an overripe fruit, and he cries out, staggering backward.
That's not how a lady is supposed to act,
he says. But between the inebriation and the blood running down his face, it comes out,
"That's not how a lady is supposed to act."
Someone grabs his ankle. The rebel. His enemy pulls hard. The whole world goes tipsy-tumble as he falls, crashing hard against a chair. By now, patrons of the castle stand, watching. Freaks in masks, disgusting aliens, sneer-lipped mercenaries. Criminals, the lot of them. He's about to yell at them all to stop their damn staring when the rebel rolls on top of him and starts dropping fists into his gut.
You blasted Imperial pig!
The rebel yells, raining punches. Romwell spits his own blood into the rebel's face, then shoves hard with both hands. The pilot crashes backward into a table. Glasses roll and shatter, and then everyone around starts gasping and moving aside. It takes Romwell long, too long, to figure out why. Above him stands a droid. Strangest damn protocol droid he's ever seen. An exoskeleton like burnished bronzium, and peaky spikes coming off the robot's legs, arms, and skull. It chatters at him in some machine language, then repeats in basic with a mechanized female voice.
You have violated the castle's law. The castle is all. Castigation is now imminent.
And I'd violate it again, you damn dirty...
The droid points her hands at him, the fingers splayed out. The tips of those fingers suddenly fire at him like little rockets, each sticking in the fabric of his shirt. He spies five thin golden filaments now connecting his chest with her hands via those fingertips. The droid's hands glow. Electricity courses along the filaments. Everything lights up like a supernova. And then it goes dark, like the deepest night. Next thing he knows, he's gasping awake on a filthy cot, matted with stinking straw. The chains holding the cot to the brick rattle as he rolls off. His head feels like a kicked pumpkin.
He vomits onto his own hands. The floor is damp and cold.
There, a door. Old wood, held fast with hinges of ancient iron. At the top of the door is a small window. Romwell crawls to the door and pulls himself up to that opening. All the while, his brain feels like it's trying to ram its way out of his forehead. He pushes his face against the smaller bars in the window.
Help!
He says, louder again.
Help! We're done for,
says the rebel, who stares out a similar window behind a similar door across the hall. Water drips from the vaulted ceiling above.
Face it, pig. We messed up. Now we have to pay for it. You don't know what you're talking about,
Romwell says, then feels his gorge rising anew. He chokes it back and burps into his hand.
I know there's one law and we broke it. Why'd you come at me like that? I didn't kill your family.
Romwell thinks.
Did I say he did?
Maybe he did. Fine. Not you specifically. But your people. They killed my family. My boy.
The rebel frowns and looks down at fingers gripping the bars.
If that happened, then I'm sorry it happened. But war isn't exactly a game of precision. Much as we hope it would be. Whatever helps you sleep at night, scum. Hey, we didn't blow up a whole planet. That was you. I didn't authorize that. And I didn't kill your family. But your belief in this nonsense republic contributed to...
From farther down the hall, a sharp voice commands,
Silence!
It's a woman's voice. Sounds old. Footsteps pad on the stone toward them. The wizened woman, Maz Kanata, reveals herself. She's withered and shriveled like a fruit left too long on the vine. Her hands are behind her back, and she looks to both the rebel and the imperial with puckered eyes pressed behind round, moon-sized lenses. She says.
Listen, Miss Kanata,
the pilot says.
Mrs. Kanata, whatever, we're really sorry for what we did. If that brute didn't think to attack me...
Romwell interrupts.
Brute! Brute! You and your rebels are the brutes, indiscriminately bombing...
Another shush from Maz Kanata. It echoes like a serpent's chastisement, and Romwell is surprised at how effective it is at clamping both their mouths shut. Maz goes over and grabs a two-step stool from against the wall, then drags it to the door in front of Romwell's cell. She clears her throat as she steps up onto it. With the boost, she can stare in through the portal.
Let me see you,
she says, adjusting one of the lenses around her eyes.
Come on. Come. Closer now.
What is this mad old pirate going on about? He keeps his head back, and she clucks her tongue.
You either come closer, or I'll send Emmy down here again to give you a proper shocking. Hmm?
Grousing, Romwell does as she commands. He leans in. Her little raisin eyes pinch to slits, and she wets her lips with a dark purple tongue.
I see pain in your eyes. Loss. Regret. You have caused pain, too. You have given loss.
She puckers her thin lips.
The scales are balanced, it seems. As for your people...
What do you mean, the scales? What about my people?
The Empire is dead,
she declares.
You may think it has life, and everyone else may think it is dying. But I say that it is dead. But just as a carcass gives way to new life, flies and fungus and whatnot, so too will the corpses of the Empire birth new creatures. For now, though, it is dead.
Her hand rattles the lock by the door, and then frees it. She steps off the stool, and then lets the door drift open.
You are free to go. Do not come back here. And I advise you not to share your pain with the rest of the galaxy. Find peace for yourself, or no good will come to you.
Romwell doesn't know what to say. Should he thank her? Condemn her? Better still to say nothing at all. Instead, he flits his eyes toward the rebel. It's as if she's reading his mind.
Do not worry about him. I'll let him go, too. But only after I see your ship in the sky above my castle.
Romwell nods, and Romwell leaves. Later, when he's gone, and when the rebel pilot has gone, too, she stands alone on one of her parapets, overlooking the waters of Nymeeve Lake.
She feels pushed and pulled from all sides, and so she goes with it, letting her body sway.
ME-89 comes up alongside. She asks the old droid, a droid who has been at this castle longer than Maz herself has been, a droid who has seen so much of this galaxy that to plumb the depths of her databank would be an effort of futility and madness. If Minlin Weil and his band have their beds for the night, and the droid replies that they do.
Peace has returned to the castle,
8D9 says.
Good. Still, peace has not returned to my heart. Something is off balance. Some stirring in the force has made the water turbid. Hard to see, but I think it best we be prepared.
Please, define the next course of action.
Get the stranger's fortune ready for flight. I want to have a look around the galaxy. See just what I can see.
Acceptable.
The droid does not belong to her. ME-89 does not belong to anybody. The droid is her own master. As it should be. Maz listens to her go, then closes her eyes and tries to feel the tremors in the galaxy. The weave and weft of a changing force. Chapter 15. One by one, the team members arrive in the Sky Garden above the Polis district of Hana City. It's where the citizens often gather to openly debate politics, which is apparently a favorite activity here on Chandrilla. To Nora's mind, it just sounds wearisome. She'd far prefer going home and fixing a meal, or be out doing something, anything other than discussing politics. Yes, she recognizes that such a discussion has value, participating in democracy and all that. Just the same, she'd rather be 100 parsecs from it. Thankfully, today, no such debate is present. The Sky Garden has been sealed, and they are, for the moment, alone with one another.
"Something's going on,"
Jazz says, leaning up against a planter. Her arms are crossed, and she's chewing a piezo stick, a dried, cured branch from the slickbark tree. Chandrillans chew it and suck the juices to stay awake. Pilots in particular love them when they can get them.
"It's a little too strange that all this stuff is happening. Two heroes of the Rebellion go missing, then the probe droid signaling a Star Destroyer, and with Toshu somehow wound up in all this. I don't trust any of it."
Sinjir drapes himself backward across a bench. He spins the cap off a tarnished mercurium flask and nips at it, smacking his lips.
"Toshu's a bird trapped in a turbolift. Barking, flogging mad, that one. Still, he gave up the answer to my question without a second's thought. He wanted me to know, which makes me think not actually a General Solo is in a deep dive."
Nora nods.
"Either he's in trouble, or we are."
She expects her son to come back with some whipcrack sentiment. He's good at those when all the chits are on the table. But instead, he sits off to the side, staring at nothing. Distracted. Sullen. Nora thinks,
"I'd better get ahead of that when we're done here."
And then she wonders,
"Should I tell him about Wedge? What will he think?" Panic assails her.
Meanwhile, Jom paces, craning his head and stretching.
"Those bounty hunters did a right nasty number on me."
His joints pop and crackle as he moves them about. He grunts and shrugs.
"Maybe it's high time we realize that Solo is not our mission. We've got real targets to look after. Need I remind a lot of you that we had Admiral Ray Sloan in our sights back on Akiva? And as it turns out, she's basically the military head of the Empire these days. Let Solo be Solo. I want another shot at Sloan."
Behind them all, Mr. Bones chases after a butterfly. He catches it gingerly in the cup of his clawed hands. Then he tears its wings off. Nora refocuses and jumps in, saying,
"I'll remind you that if it weren't for Leia and Solo, that shield generator would have stayed up, and the Death Star would remain."
Her insides twist at the thought of how that would have played out. They were already outnumbered and outgunned before the beam from the battle station lit up the black and destroyed both the Liberty and the Mon Calamari cruiser Nautilian. It takes everything she has to hold it together. And she can't stop injecting a little venom into her voice when she says,
"We wouldn't be standing here if it weren't for him. So a little loyalty wouldn't go amiss, Burrell."
Nearby, there's a soft chime as the turbolift platform at the center of the park begins to rise, bringing with it a small group. Akbar leads, striding in his way, his head pointed forward as if drawn forth by the gravity of sheer purpose. Leia walks with him, speaking animatedly, worriedly. Wedge trails alongside Commodore Augate.
"Wedge."
He lifts his gaze and meets Nora's. And for just a moment, all her anxieties and all her worries fall away, like a heavy rucksack allowed to slip from her weary shoulder. That ends with the brusque sound of Akbar clearing his throat. His lips press together, and he seems poised to speak. Sinjir whistles low and slow. Nora leans forward and kicks his shin. The ex-Imperial grouses and sits up, wiping a line of liquor from his lip. Deep in his cups, he noisily whispers to the others,
"We are about to be reprimanded by the Academy Commandant, children. Shh! This is not a reprimand,"
Akbar says gruffly.
"You were operating under my request,"
Leia says, and then adds with a crisp shot of bitterness,
"I'm the one who received the reprimand."
"Sir," Nora says,
"with all due respect..."
But the Mon Calamari does that thing he does, where he shuts you up with a look. his bold golden eyes fix on her.
Han Solo, as I understand it, has resigned his military commission. And even if he had not, we cannot pivot the entire New Republic to search for one man willfully gone off the reservation. We're already overextended. Our reclamation of systems is slow. Our grip tenuous. Your team, Lieutenant Wexley, is designed to serve a single purpose. And finding a smuggler, however good-hearted and helpful he is not that purpose. Your search for Solo ends now. You will return to pursuing Imperial war criminals post-haste.
No.
That single word comes out of nowhere. Nora wonders who even spoke it aloud until she realizes it was her own voice. Akbar seems taken aback. His nostrils flare as he scowls. She says it again, wishing desperately she could catch the words before they leave her mouth and shove them back down into her throat. But the effort is futile.
No, we won't. The New Republic owes Leia and Solo a great debt. He's missing, and I think he's in danger. The Empire doesn't want us to find him, and that's all the more reason we should be looking. So, with all due respect, we will continue our search for Solo. Oh, no. What am I doing? Shut up, Nora. Shut up!
Her fears reflect back in Wedge's eyes, now as big as moons. He shakes his head at her, trying to tell her to stop.
Are you disobeying an order?
Akbar asks.
No, she thinks. I would never. I'm a pilot. I'm a soldier. I'm a rebel.
Oh.
Yes,
she says, the word erupting out of her.
I am disobeying your order. I resign my military commission. This is the right thing to do, and I aim to do it, no matter who stands in my way. I'll find Solo myself.
Sinjir sits forward, grinning like a maniac.
Well, this just stopped being tedious.
Jazz, too, looks on with a smirk, twisting the ends of her mouth. Though Nora doesn't know if that smirk signifies approval or amusement or something else entirely. Jom, on the other hand, looks like he just ate a piece of rotten meat. And Temin? He's already at her side.
I'm in too, Mom.
Leia steps forward. She clasps Nora's hands in her own.
Lieutenant Wexley, Nora, please reconsider. Don't do this to yourself. Not for me.
Why not?
You do it for me. For all of us. That person, the princess and general and all the Holovids, that's not some creation. It's not propaganda. It's you. You gave up so much for us. You lost your world. At least let me get your husband back.
Nora leans forward, and in a much lower voice says,
And a child needs its parents. I know that now.
Leia appears speechless. All she can do is acquiesce with a small nod.
That's done, then,
Nora says, as her heart churns, excited and panicked, blood through her veins. She feels woozy, like she's on the edge of something. But it feels good. It feels right.
Private Citizen Nora Wexley, I suspect this meeting no longer involves me. If you'll excuse me, Admiral, I have matters I must attend to.
The matters Nora must attend to include, in order, A, trying very hard not to vomit, B, trying doubly hard not to pass out, C, feeling both lost and free at the same time, which is probably why she feels like vomiting and passing out. She stands at the far side of the Sky Garden, away from the others, just out of sight. She can't go. Not yet. Her legs are too wobbly, and she's not really even sure where she's going. That's the thing. For so many years now, she's been on rails, fixed to a track, not of her own making. She almost jumped that track on Akiva, but it wasn't long before duty called, and once again she was swept up in someone else's cause.
Admittedly, it felt comfortable. It felt easy. Following orders is simple. But the galaxy isn't simple, is it? The Empire is about following orders, but the Rebel Alliance was about changing all that. Tossing it on its head and flipping up an obscene gesture before walking out of the room. The Empire didn't care about individuals. It cared only about itself. Still does. But Nora wants to care about people again. Not orders. Not governments. She adds a new matter she must attend to when she tries not to cry. She fails. Nora sobs. Her shoulders hitch, and what comes out of her is a desperate animal sound. Brenton, her husband, Temin's father. Brenton is lost precisely because she got swept up in someone else's cause. And now her chances of getting him back are gone. Because she chose a path bigger and greater, even if it wasn't her own. It was his. It was Brenton's cause. He was the rebel. She just wanted to be a mother to her son. The galaxy, she hoped then, would sort itself out. She leans forward, wiping up tears with a drag of her forearm. A hand falls upon her shoulder. It's her son. She sweeps him up into a hug. He oofs a little and then goes with it, hugging her back. Approaching under a copse of flyleaf trees are both Sinjir and Jazz, with Bones tootling behind. Nora says to them,
"Sorry to do that back there. I know I'm abandoning you and the team, but..."
"Shut up,"
Jazz says, rolling her eyes.
"We're in."
"What?"
"We're going to help you find Solo."
Sinjir snorts.
"Little Miss Bounty Hunter here even negotiated a truly impressive fee for the job."
"Shut it, Rathbillis."
10 credits. 10. "We're getting paid enough that we can probably spit a steaming copter bun. Or buy 4 bottles of Jogan juice.
Small bottles.
We'll be richer than in our wildest dreams.
Provided that our wildest dreams have us living in total destitution. You've gone soft, Amari."
"Like the lady said, we have debts. I pay mine."
"And John?" Nora asks.
Jazz scowls.
"No. The coward is sticking with them. And Tilly's too."
"That's fine. They have to follow their path. We have ours. So let's get to work."
She draws a deep breath and wonders exactly what they're getting themselves into.
Han Solo is apparently not going to find himself.
Part 3, Chapter 16. The veldt stretches out before them. The keaki bushes tremble in the warm wind, dark thorny scrubs whose gentle tremors call to mind an animal trying very hard not to be seen. The thirst grass conspires with the breeze, whispers and shushes and hissed hushes. Red feathery clouds streak across the open sky, a sky the color of blush and bloom. A lone ship crosses it, some cargo ship probably, one of the few travelers to this distant world of Iridiru. Down there, among the grass and the scrub, sits a compound. The compound has 7 buildings. Each sits squat and rectangular, each made of blonde brick and blood-red mortar, each with rail-top roofs and round porthole windows and water catchment tanks. One of the buildings is different, though. A manse larger and more ostentatious than the other, more austere buildings. The house is surrounded by a screened-in porch, a xeriscape garden, and a series of shimmering and shifting hollow statues. A droid with many extensor limbs flits about, tending to the garden and tuning up the statues. Otherwise, the compound is silent and still. And it has been for the better part of the last day. This is the compound of Golos Aram. What the crew knows about Aram is little, but perhaps enough. The big-headed Sinatine was once employed by the Galactic Empire as an architect.
A prison architect, in fact. Aram designed some of the Empire's most notable prisons, including the Lemnis Gate beneath Coruscant, the floating asteroid prison of Orko 9, and the Goa penal colony. Aram's reported specialty was making prisons that were self-sustaining and inescapable. He considered it his art. Thing is, he didn't work only for the Empire. He operated freelance, too, helping design and build prisons for the Kanji Club, for the Junahar Cartel, even for Splugora the Hutt. Aram is retired, supposedly. Just the same, Aram is the only Imperial connection out here on Iridiru. He's the one good lead they have. But what happens when they go pulling on that thread? Will they find Han Solo? Or will the whole thing fall apart? Could they be putting Solo in danger? The narrative they can put together for Solo is shaky at best. The Millennium Falcon got into a scrap not far from Warren Station. Han had transmitted after that, but whatever he was investigating sure stirred up trouble. Given the presence of that Prowler droid, plus the information from Black Sun, and the sheer manic glee of Tashu regarding Iridiru, there's cause to worry. So if Han was here investigating Aram, then what? After that, the narrative frays. Why look into Aram at all? Did Aram catch Solo sniffing around? Is Solo in prison? Or is he looking for someone in prison?